For many people, the name Christopher Isherwood is synonymous with the Berlin of the early 1930s. Why did you choose to live in Berlin?
Well, that was very largely happenstance in that Auden was there. He'd been given some money by his father to have a kind of study holiday after he graduated from Oxford. And he decided to go to Germany. As a matter of fact, I think he was in Hamburg for a while, certainly. And I think he was some places out in the country, but he had landed up in Berlin. He came back that Christmas, and he told me that it was just the most marvelous place. And, of course, one of the great attractions was the boy life, which was supposed to be going on there. The gay life was supposed to be very, very permissive and easy to follow. That now seems very strange to me. I realize that it wasn't nearly as permissive and accessible according to modern standards as people believe and as I believed at the time. But really, you know, the great thing was simply getting away from England to some other place. Getting away, shedding to some extent the whole British persona, and therefore learning to speak at least to some degree German, so that I could be a different person with a different language. That gave me a great feeling of security.
So in a sense, it was a very liberating experience for you. Did it liberate you as a writer as well?
Oh, yes, I think so. It was certainly a very wise move. Far from being irresponsible and silly, as of course it seemed from the outside, because I was a medical student, I suddenly gave the whole thing up and went off there. The funny thing, years and years later, Auden had been reading through a whole lot of my diaries, and he observed, "You've always known when to clear out." And some kind of instinct in me, some kind of backseat driver who runs one's life without one really realizing that it's happening. And by this I don't mean anything theological. I'm not talking about the will of God or destiny or anything, but I do believe that there's part of one's will which operates in this way. Simply said, look, that is all very well, that caprice with medicine and so on, and we all know that you like to think you might have been a marvelous doctor, but now I've proved to you that you can't remember Latin names for botany, let alone human anatomy, and now you can quit that. And let's get on to business. So that, in a ridiculous, paradoxical way, it was a very serious step and a prudent step. Whereas it seemed to be, of course, plunging into the abyss of vice and general depravity at a rather late age, an alarmingly late age. I was already 25, you see.
In your new book, Christopher and His Kind, you use the term nearly everybody as a way of defining the enemy. I mean, the enemy that you had at that period. And you write, "Even if my nature were like theirs, I should still have to fight them in one way or another. If boys didn't exist, I should have to invent them." Do you still feel this?
Yes, I must say I feel an instinct to be in the minority. That's quite true. Since saying this a few hundred times on various occasions, I've been reminded by somebody or other that my cousin Graham Greene made a rather similar remark, saying that he would tend to be a communist under a right-wing government and vice versa. But I understand that so well.
Well, there are two things about your writing that I most admire. One is the fact that you don't judge anybody. You seem to be tolerant of people that I suppose most of us would call extraordinary or eccentric. You treat their eccentricities as perfectly normal behavior. And the other thing is the spontaneity of your writing. It seems to happen minute by minute. Is spontaneity something that you particularly appreciate in other writers?
Oh, yes, it is. But I'd like you to define spontaneity a little bit more. I want to be quite sure we're understanding each other on
this point. Right, well, your characters don't seem to be imprisoned by the writer. There are so many novelists who seem to put the characters down on the page and you know what the novelist thinks about them all the time. Now, yours seem to be continually both surprising the narrators, and at the same time, the narrator seems to take them as perfectly ordinary behaviour. And this is a double thing. And the spontaneity seems to me that your writing doesn't seem to be imprisoned by plot and psychological explanation all the time. It seems to be happening minute by minute.
My good writing is, my bad writing is when I yield to a sort of fatal desire for plot. Because, as a matter of fact, the worst of it is I have a certain knack of plotting, and I enjoy it very much. In the movies, it's quite different because, of course, films have to be constructed to a much greater degree. And there I really thoroughly enjoy constructing a film. But when I've written very plotty books, they've been inferior to the others, particularly The World in the Evening, which is a miracle of plotting, but not much else. You just begin to see the bones through the flesh, I feel.
Well, I rather admire it, but...
Well, I defer to a much greater critic than I am. People do like it, yes, it's true, but some people, but it isn't my sort of book. Now, what I always feel is, it was put awfully well by a great friend of mine, Francis Bacon, the great artist, when he said, and how he does it, I always try to get down to the nerve. And I feel that that's the thing. It's the feeling of encountering characters, encountering human beings, and everything that goes on when they start reaching out their antennae towards each other. That is what fascinates me. And the whole feel and smell and sense of people together, that's really what it's all about as far as I'm concerned.
When do you know that a book is there? Could you say something about your way of writing a novel, how it actually starts?
It starts very tentatively. In the case of this book, of course, since there was a big factual background involved, I just started, first of all, sort of shoveling in everything which might be in the book. Of that material, about at least a third was rejected on one ground or another. And I started sort of putting it together in quite a loose way. Of course, the narrative is foreordained by the fact that you're writing about real life in the past. I started following the narrative. But then, of course, something else operates. And without lying or departing from the facts, you do begin to arrange the thing so it becomes more like a novel. That's to say, you discern in this slice of time that you have, that you're describing, you discern certain movements of yourself. Of course, I set out with one thesis that this was an account of why I went to the United States. And so I did permit myself certain, just to take this as one example, certain little liberties, like if there was any mention of America anywhere, I struck it like a note in a symphony. For instance, one time Stephen Spender wrote me a letter, way back in the fairly early 30s, saying, "Why don't you go to America? I feel that you would be able to write even better there than you could in Europe, and then you could take Heinz," that was my German friend, "with you, and you could start a new life there." And there are things like that all through the book. Again, when I met the film director, Berthold Viertel, who's called Friedrich Bergmann in my novelette, Prater Violet, he was, of course, always talking about America because that was his home then. He'd moved there himself with his wife and family. And he used to talk about the place where he lived, which actually is a stone's throw from where I now myself live, in Santa Monica Canyon in California, on the outskirts of Los Angeles, beside the ocean. And so again and again, I keep striking this note, America, America. And he says, "You must come there. You must come and see us. You'll meet Garbo if you come there." All kinds of things like that. And so I find myself gradually shaping the book a little bit in that sort of way. And there are certain omens of disaster come in, you know, things that are going to go wrong are pre-announced. But it's not really cheating because they were.
You seem to have an extraordinary ability to be able to write about yourself. A lot of writers would hesitate to do this, preferring to get into the skins of other people only. I get the impression that you are rediscovering another Christopher Isherwood, perhaps, who existed before. Is that a fair question?
I feel that very strongly. I feel very strongly that the I of the 1930s was quite different. Not absolutely different, of course, but considerably different. This thing of being interested in myself was actually not nearly so true at that period, because in the books I wrote about Berlin, I was far more interested in describing other people. That's why I reduced myself down to almost a kind of scanning device, an observer, a recorder, a camera, to coin an unfortunate phrase, which became much too widely used about me, because I really was never a non-mixer at all, quite the reverse. I didn't sit there watching all these people. I was up to the neck in their affairs and doings, and often gravely compromised by them. But, you know, it always sounds as though you sat kind of aloof watching the thing. That wasn't me at all. Nevertheless, in the books it is, because I wasn't writing about myself. Well, now I am. That's the only difference.
I think you have actually been misjudged by some critics who say that you are an entirely autobiographical novelist. I think they obviously haven't read the books very closely, because as you've just said, they are full of the lives of other people, and you have created two or three really memorable characters who have taken on a life, as it were, apart from Christopher Isherwood. You know, Sally Bowles is a name that has entered the language. Do you resent ever being called an autobiographical novelist?
No, I don't resent that. One critic exclaimed on one occasion, "Can't he invent anything?" But as a matter of fact, that is unjust, because I invent far more than they suspect. It's only that then I'm like the fiend in Macbeth who lies like truth. So they're taken in by it.
Yes, I suppose it's because we know that there were the prototypes alive for some of your characters. I think this has obviously been unfortunate in some way, because people think, oh, he's just sat down and put them on the page. But clearly you have reinvented a lot of things.
Oh, yes. Well, I put it to myself like this, actually. If you tell stories about yourself, especially in a bar or somewhere when there's a few drinks, you start exaggerating. Well, I exaggerate. And exaggeration really is fiction. I mean, you begin changing all the values of the thing and setting it up in another way. The very fact, the very stance from which the Berlin material is observed is in itself an absolute distortion of the facts. And that's true of my other books, too. And then by just leaving things out, you take a book I wrote, A Single Man, which is narrated in a very peculiar way. It's actually narrated by a non-human observer who is watching the principal character, knows everything that he thinks, and knows all about everybody else in the story. And there, the principal character could certainly be said to be myself, but by one single fact, the fact that his life is bereaved, that his lover is dead, I absolutely falsify the entire picture then and there. Everything is re-slanted. Everything is different.
I get the impression from reading Christopher and His Kind that you rather wish that you had made more of your narrator in the early Berlin stories, that you had made him a bit more solid, a bit more honest, perhaps.
I do and I don't. I've been thinking about it backwards and forwards since I wrote this latest book. But then I really come back to it. You know, the fact still remains that if I had made him more interesting. I think the other characters would have suffered. I'm perfectly willing to admit that I also had the motive of prudence, that I didn't want to come out and, for instance, say that I was gay at that time. That's quite true. But that's only part of the motive. And I think that the backseat driver certainly had quite other motives. I think his motives were entirely literary, really.
You mentioned A Single Man just now. That is a favorite book of mine. It's about a homosexual. Did you feel then, when you'd finished the book, that you were coming out, in a sense? I mean, the book seems to me to be a very moving account of a homosexual life that isn't bizarre, that isn't strange, that isn't perverted or odd in any way. It's a love story, in a sense, isn't it?
Yes, I rather wish I had heightened that aspect of it, incidentally, since you mentioned that. We could quite well have had a few flashbacks or more memories of this other character, Jim, I think he's called. He remains very much in the background, which I think was rather a pity. Did I feel I was coming out? That's difficult to say. You see, in the first place, my life has always been very openly lived. And I never went in for any kind of concealment, such as leaving my friend at home when I went out for a party, like some people do, if grand people are present, and things like that. I felt I had to be completely open, although I didn't talk about it all that much, I suppose. Then I began fairly early, I think certainly before A Single Man, mentioning it to interviewers and people of this kind. And that was done increasingly. I wouldn't be sure when I first really did that in a big way, but it's quite a long time ago now. So this thing gradually sort of got itself together. And it's very difficult to say. Of course, it's quite true that it wasn't till a book about my parents, Kathleen and Frank, that I actually came right out and said it about myself in print. Because then it's the first time it was absolutely necessary. This being a completely factual biography of my parents and the little bit that was devoted to me, an autobiography of myself. And there was no two ways about it, because what was of interest there was, of course, the attitude of Kathleen, my mother, toward the situation. And to have left that out would have made her character somewhat less than complete.
There is something I want to ask you about that. Not only are you frank about your sexual feelings, you're also extremely frank, I think, about yourself as a person. You quote the not altogether favorable remarks that your friends often made about you. Auden said that you were rather a cruel, cold person in some way, didn't he?
The cruelest and most unscrupulous person he had ever met. I really put this in, I must say, not just out of a kind of masochism, but a little bit because it surprises me. I have had it said to me on various occasions, but usually by people who were very fond of me. And so what they meant by cruel can't have been anything quite as dreadful as it sounds. Unscrupulous. I seem to be, to myself, a mass of scruples. But I thought one should always quote the bad notices as well as the good ones, so I put it in. And also, I mean, I think it throws a certain light on Auden. I feel there a sort of curious yin quality in Auden was responding to, it sounds ridiculous to put it like this, to a kind of yang quality in me, whether he thought it was sort of masculine to be cruel or something. I don't know. It's a real mystery to me, and I'd be always very interested for any elucidation of it, but I couldn't leave it out of the book.
You mention E.M. Forster in the book, and you mention him always with terms of great affection and admiration. You call him the great genius of our tribe at one point. He's obviously been an enormous influence on you.
Well, from a literary point of view, there was something. These things are almost indefinable because you can't really lay it on the line and say what his qualities were as a writer and how those affected me. It was the whole, his whole attitude as a writer, the tone of voice that he had as a writer, his motives for telling you what he was telling you. All this seemed to me just what I could learn from what I wanted. I instinctively aped it a little. Later on, I became aware of aping it and therefore kind of cut down on that. But nevertheless, the underlying attitude to the material remained largely Forster's in many respects. Now, that's a statement probably people would challenge very much. I don't know. Some people would say I was a very different kind of writer, but this is a matter of the deepest feelings. It's something so central that I can't even look at it quite and define it. I can only feel it. I use the image that just as the Zen masters of archery taught you the spirit, the mental attitude with which you should pick up the bow, long before you took an arrow or thought of firing at the target. Well, in the same way, that's what I got from Forster, the sort of spirit in which you pick up the pen or sit down at the typewriter. As for the other qualities, there was, of course, the feeling of a man to whom I was more than ready to defer, to whose moral judgment I was very ready to defer. I felt that he was really a sort of eye watching my life. And when I did things that I was ashamed of, nevertheless, I wanted him to know about them. To put it in the usual manner, he was a father figure, undoubtedly. And indeed, curiously close to the role played in a more official manner by the Hindu monk Prabhavananda, who became my guru in 1939 and remained so. Well, of course, I was going to say till his death this year, but of course he still is, obviously. It doesn't make any difference that he's dead any more than it makes any difference to me that Forster is dead. They're very, very present in my mind. And those two people, I suppose, are the two great sort of father figures in my life.
Are there any writers other than Forster whom you learnt from when you began writing?
D.H. Lawrence, very much. What I learned from D.H. Lawrence was something very, very simple, but for me very important, which is the marvelous subjective quality that he had. If he was in a bad humor, Yosemite Valley was ugly. In other words, it's the simplest human truth, but he exemplified it in the most extraordinary way, that he could do that. He projected the feelings of somebody onto the landscape. And this method of describing things, of describing people too, in other words, that you were allowed to be absurdly prejudiced. That was something that was absolutely a revelation to me. It sounds funny now.
As against those writers who couldn't do something like that, who didn't put... Did you feel that then that he was putting the whole of himself into his books? Was this something that appealed to you? Because it could be said the complaints about him as a novelist are that he intrudes too much at times, that he...
Oh, yes, yes. Well, I like that, of course. I mean, as long as it was Lawrence. But, of course, you'd better be good. Like Wilde's great line, not everyone who says I can enter into the kingdom of the ego. Because some people's egos are so boring, you don't want to hear about them.
Absolutely. There's a feeling that you are, in a sense, a historical novelist, if I may put it like that, that you look back on certain aspects of your past and then write about them. That you have to live through these things first. I don't think of you as a writer who suddenly gets a brilliant idea and sets it down. Obviously, you have brilliant ideas, but your life seems to go hand in hand with your work. That the books follow something that you've discovered or have been in the process of discovering in your past life.
Yes, that's true. And it's quite true that as far as I personally am concerned, the other thing seems to me just being clever. We can all be clever. I mean, we make up some story about some fantastic character who did something fantastic, and then some more people came and it got fantastica and fantastica. As far as I'm concerned, that's all just flufla, you know. When other people do it, sometimes I enjoy what they do very much, but it's nothing for me, that kind of sport. It's a sort of indoor game.
Was The World in the Evening a deliberate attempt to get away from the type of novel that you'd been writing? Because it is radically different, not in its style, but in the whole design from your other books.
I know, that's why I don't like it, but it all started off with a good old usual things that I'd had a whole lot of experience that I wanted to present. As a matter of fact, what I was really concerned with was a period of my life about which I haven't written, except that either during my life or after my death, when my diaries are published, it's all covered in that. And that was a period of nearly a year which I spent working in a Quaker hostel in the East, in Haverford, Pennsylvania, looking after a whole lot of refugees from Central Europe. When I say looking after them, what I mean is that they were living there. They were all, most of them, professional people. And they were trying to get adjusted to the American way of doing things so that they could take jobs, mostly as teachers, in the American academic system. In due course, they did become so adjusted, and then along came the war situation, or rather the involvement of the United States in the war after Pearl Harbor, and suddenly the labor market needed recruits because everybody had been drafted, and so a whole lot of them got jobs, and they did indeed adjust to some degree, and our task was over, which was keeping them a roof over their heads while they were waiting for this. They began to earn money on their own and began to have a life of their own. Well, I wanted to write about that very much, and there are vestiges of that in The World in the Evening. That's the most solid part of the book. But then a sort of mania for construction introduced another theme into it, which gradually, slowly pushed the refugees out. So that in the finished book, there's only one refugee left, literally. And the book which I was going to write just isn't there.
In many ways, one of the most memorable parts of that book was the mention of the word camp, which when I read it a long time ago, seemed to be quite a new thing. I think you were one of the first people to actually define camp. I mean, that, at least to an English reader, that seems such a strange thing.
Well, I defined it quite arbitrarily. I simply defined it in the sense that I've always felt there was a word which we needed very badly and hadn't got, which describes a certain type of art, sometimes art of the very highest kind. And I never did find any other word that quite covers it. What it is, the basic thing about camp in my definition is that it is laughter, fun, gaiety, frivolity about something which one takes fundamentally absolutely seriously. It is essentially something which can afford to laugh because it is absolutely sincere and wholehearted in its belief in whatever it's laughing about. And the crude examples that I came on first of all were, for instance, that the classical ballet is camp about romantic love. That's to say, by reducing romantic love to a kind of language of balletic gestures and movements, it makes it tremble on the very edge of ridiculousness. And yet it's enchanting. And its enchantment is really based on the fact that romantic love is not for one moment being put down. In the same way, Baroque ecclesiastical architecture, church architecture, is camp about religion. It's camp about heaven. It's camp about the concept of God. It doesn't for one moment express disbelief. And these things are of the essence when you're describing certain great masters. For instance, Mozart is, I suppose, the most camp genius, certainly in music. And you can take various examples. In this particular book, I said, for instance, that Flaubert was absolutely not camp, but Dostoevsky was. And always what you get is there's a kind of hilarious laughter somewhere in the situation.
Yes, I think a lot of people misunderstood that reference to Dostoevsky. They thought it was being dismissive. I think psycho camp or something was the word. I know exactly what you mean by that. He is an hilarious writer in many ways. Is that quality of gaiety something that you treasure in other artists?
Oh, I do, yes. I do very much. I mean, I think that total seriousness, like total frivolity, can only produce second-rate work. There must be something more than that. Approaching it from another angle, Gerald Hurd was very fond of using, he was always coining words, a word, meta-comedy, which was the comedy beyond comedy and tragedy. It's very conveniently expressed in one of Wilfred Owen's war poems. Merry it was to laugh there when death became absurd and life absurder. And merry is a very, very important choice of adjective there, I think.
Yes.
Because there was a genuine merriment in this. Some of the very greatest moments in art are a sort of transcendence of the tragic. For instance, you find it very much in Shakespeare when he gets really quite carried away in Lear, for instance, on the heath, something of this kind. The tremendous scene at the end of Moby Dick when the ship is sinking. And I think it's Tashtego, one of the members of the crew, is up on the top of the mast. And as the Pequod goes down, a seabird swoops down, and Tashtego, who's nailing the flag to the mast, holds the bird's wing, and the bird goes down with the ship. And Melville says something about, like Lucifer, it couldn't sink to hell without taking a living creature with it or something. And Melville is absolutely reveling in this scene. I mean, the absurdity of the whole thing, the whale dashing at the ship and the ship going down and everybody drowned and good old Ishmael still afloat. That's camp. And it's extremely serious. It doesn't deny that people were really drowned and that it was dreadful.
Are you working on anything now? Are you attempting another novel?
Well, there are two things. You see, since this book really arose out of the fact that I had decided to publish my diaries of the first years in the United States, and is really a preface to them, I may just go on ahead and publish the diaries. That'll be a lot of work because I'm going to annotate them with remarks from the point of view of the present. And also, they'd have to be very much cut because they're enormously long. I think they're about 300,000 words just to take you through to the end of 1944. So there's that. But then again, I'm tremendously drawn to at least trying to write a memoir, it might be quite short, of Swami Prabhavananda from a very subjective point of view of the encounter of these wildly dissimilar people, the Swami and myself, and what it meant to me personally, not generalizing about him or how he was with other people, but just trying to deal with all of that. And I'm going to start playing around with that almost immediately. And if it seems promising, if I say something that interests me, then I'll go on with that. But I don't know yet.
After your first encounter with him, did you feel that he obviously changed your life in a very radical way? Is the Isherwood, the novelist who has lived in America, different from the European Isherwood to you?
Oh, well, very much so, because, I mean, it wasn't just altogether the encounter with the States was profoundly altering, no question. It's very hard to define exactly what happened, and it all took place very slowly, not quickly at all. I mean, as far as the Swami was concerned, there were a lot of sort of immediate adjustments, which didn't really mean very much and were only kind of skin deep. But the larger view of the whole thing and how it gradually translated itself into one's deepest feelings, that was very slow. And that's what I'm going to try and define. And, of course, it was mixed up with being in America, too. That was all happening to me simultaneously. You see, it's rather a paradoxical thing in a way that I came all the way out here, and far from meeting a whole lot of Americans, particularly other than a lover that I had with me, they were Hindu monk, a British and Anglo-Irish intellectual, I mean Huxley and Gerald Hurd, people like that, a great number of refugees from Nazi Germany, Jewish refugees of one kind or another, ranging from the, the Viertel family, who were really, in a way, my kind of sponsors, and who led, me into the possibility of earning money in the films, because they knew all kinds of people who were working in the films. My first important job was with one of Reinhardt's sons, Gottfried Reinhardt. So all that is strange. I mean, I got to know America in a way rather indirectly, because these were the people I spent most of my time with.
Can we talk again about your homosexuality? To me, the most moving aspect of Christopher and His Kind is the fact when you talk about people like André Gide, whom you at first didn't like, but then you came to realize that he was a great spokesman for our tribe. This seems to me to be a marvelous way of putting it. You say the same about Forster. Do you think that it's a moral duty, a moral imperative now for homosexuals to say, here I am, I don't care what the world thinks?
I wouldn't say that. All I would say is that I think we all ought to do something. The people who want to remain in deadly secrecy are, many of them, quite wealthy, and they could give an awful lot more than they do to various causes in complete anonymity. As for speaking out and all that, again, I mean, I know so many cases where one would lose one's job and all this sort of thing. I do think that those of us who are in a position, as writers, of course, are, where they're much more, the attitude toward them is much more permissive, because we're supposed to be kind of bohemian and irresponsible and dissolute. I do think it's good for them to speak, yes. But I would never dictate that kind of thing to other people. I do think one should do something. And I, of course, realize also that different ages of one's life imply different duties. They're still, unless you have the bad luck to meet a particularly dangerous kind of juvenile delinquent, there's still some protection in having an aged head. And you can get away with certain things and say certain things to certain people which you couldn't get away with under 70. And I do believe in using that. It's a weapon like any other.
You pay regular visits to England. How do you feel about England now?
Oh, well, I adore England, and I have many, many friends. I think I have more friends in London to this day than I do here or in New York. Goodness knows, in spite of my desertion, I've, on the whole, had an extraordinary amount of support and encouragement from England since I've lived in this country. And sometimes I almost think that the English rather like prodigals, prodigal sons.
You think that the American public has yet to really appreciate you?
Well, it's very hard to say that. I don't know. No, I mean, I get wonderful, wonderful letters, especially from young people. It's always young people. Perhaps like Cyril Connolly said crushingly about A.E. Housman, I only appeal to the young. Well, I wish I were A.E. Housman anyway.
Well, I think you've done quite a lot as Christopher Isherwood.